super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Ladies and gentlemen, the man who's going to kill his producer, 42nd Street Pete!
Yeah, well, actually, we had a wonderful tribute show taped Thursday night for Bill Heinzman and Josie Striner, and we had Kyra Sean on, we had CineWasteland.com Ken on, we had Petey from Spooky Empire, we had Half-Breed Billy DeGrame, we had Gary Striner, we had a ton of people, Jim from Autopsy of the Living Dead. But unfortunately, the internet did something messed up. Oh, excuse me? Petey, I said Petey, didn't I?
Hey, Ghastly
Ghoul. Oh, Ghastly Ghoul.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, Ghastly Ghoul. But unfortunately, the internet decided to eat the episode or something, or Todd pushed the wrong button. I don't know, you know, like they said, we want to kill a producer. Well, we do, but, you know.
It wasn't my fault.
I can't afford the gas to drive to Missouri right now, but maybe down the road. So watch it. But anyway, we're going to try to resurrect a little bit of this thing because we're joined again by Kyra and Ken and whoever else might deem the call in. And we're going to try to call Half-Breed Billy Graham after the break because that's all we can take of him, actually. So, welcome back to the show,
guys.
You might
be listening live. Billy, we can take you for, you know, 20 minutes.
Here we go. We got a caller here, Pete.
Who's that?
It's Billy, man.
Billy. Oh, it's Billy. Okay, Billy.
Hey, Billy.
I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know because somebody tried to call in when I was on the phone, and I thought it might be you guys because it was a 310 area code. So I went back and I looked. And do you want me to wait till later? Or what's?
Well, you're here. I mean, you know,
since you're here.
Who all's there? Who's there?
It's just me and Kyra tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Kyra.
Hey, Billy. How are you?
I'm hanging, man. How are you guys doing?
Okay. For those of you who don't know who this is, this is Half-Breed Billy Graham. He was a good friend of Bill's. He always said that Bill was like a father to him, and he was like a son to Bill. So welcome back, and I apologize for the fuck-up on behalf of the station for losing all the shit Thursday night.
Or on the East Coast who just listened to heavy metal for a minute.
Hey, they're okay now.
I don't think it's really necessary to apologize for technical mistakes, but your fucking mouth, dude, is horrible. I mean, your language, you really need to fucking stop that, right?
I know. I'm trying to curb it myself, you know?
Well,
I threatened to
ass
rape him, and that doesn't help.
So you guys... where should I jump in here? What did you guys talk about?
Everybody was nice and respectful last time. We had talked about how Bill loves the fans, and you know, he used to like to jump into gimmick after he did the play, which you said you came up and attended the play, and then he had the suit, so he wore that around every show and got into it every Saturday, you know?
Absolutely. It's something
fans
always appreciated that too, you know what I mean, that he would go to that length. I mean, a lot of people probably wouldn't, you know, and you know, it was fun for everybody. I mean, obviously great photo ops to say, hey, look, this is me and zombie number one here and everything, but I guess you touched on something there. I would definitely like to say you said about him, you know, being nice to the fans and something. It's kind of like I was lucky ever since I've been a kid with my first mentor, the famous comic book artist Jim Steranko, like, and all through my life, and anybody that I like kind of had as a mentor in the entertainment business with what my attitude is, the Night of Living Dead people, everyone has been more of an example of this to me and ingrained it even more in my head and my psyche since I met them all, and that was the idea that there is no such thing as a fan, that it's friends who appreciate consuming the things that you've created or performed. And I mean, certainly Bill never ever had any kind of pretentious attitude with any, you know, fans of Night of Living Dead or people that came up. I mean, I know Kyra can say more probably about this, but I mean, I know just from my own experience and Ken, you know this too, and Pete, like, for people that do these conventions and sit at these tables and you know, are approached by friend after friend after friend after friend, and lots of them are really, really super cool and really easy to hang out with and talk to. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, some can be a little bit obnoxious, even though they're the rarer form. But I mean, to be able to sit and with the same enthusiasm, you know, answer the same questions over and over and over again and tell the same stories over again and always make it seem like to this, you know, having the attitude that, look, this is really important to this person that's talking to me, you know, and keeping that kind of, and I mean, look, the bottom line is I'm a living example because I challenge whether there's any bigger Night of the Living Dead fan on the face of the earth than me. Because I dare say there's not. I don't care how much shit somebody's bought, collected. I've probably seen the movie 1,000 damn times, and I will probably see it another 1,000, hopefully. And I just, it's my favorite movie of all times, and you know I've always had this connection to it and been obsessed with it. So I don't think there's any bigger fan. But look at me. I mean, now the Night of the Living Dead family are like part of my family, or I'm part of theirs, however you want to put it. And certainly if there was that kind of wall there, that relationship wouldn't exist. Now, the ones that come up and start with, hey, remember when you were in that movie? Remember when you were fighting with Russ Striner? Remember when he, you know, I know that one kind of sometimes got on Bill's nerves. Like, what do you mean, do I remember it? I did it. Of course I remember it, you know what I mean? But that's just kind of the thing of, like, but still never saw him react that way to the person, you know, that was... You know, like, always still acted very, very cordially. I know it was a big deal for... yesterday, I watched something I had not seen before, which was the Bite Me episode of the show Medium. For people that don't know, you guys see... You saw that episode where she was... Well, that was, you know, that was broadcast during Halloween of 2009, while Bill and I were at Chiller. And while it was on the air and stuff like that, people were coming up, you know, telling him about it. And he's going, what? Like... And everything, and then, you know, we talked about it later, like, how that's kind of screwed up, like, you know, here'll be another thing where the creators and owners of Night of the Living Dead will not get credit again, and now everybody's talking about it. Well, I mean, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way the other day, because first I was like, I wonder what that episode was called. So I searched, you know, Medium Night of the Living Dead, and one of the first things I found was an article talking about the episode, and I saw the title. And then right there is the director of the show saying, so the first thing we did was, like, you know, we searched out what were public domain movies, and we were shocked when we found out that Night of the Living Dead is public domain. And, you know, well, really, technically, that's a debatable issue, because it may be considered and looked at and viewed and dealt with legally that it's public domain, but it's my contention to this day that it isn't public domain and that it is somebody's property and they should own it. But, you know, same thing, like, yeah, there it was, you know, and... All my friends there are all over the place in that thing, and it was brilliant what they did. But yeah, at the end of the movie, like, there wasn't any credits. You know, it didn't say Judith O'Day, Bill Hinesman, Kyra Shaw, you know, like, the people that were seen were not given credit. It didn't say Night of the Living Dead, you know, directed by George Romero and written by Gianna. Like, right. Night of the Living Dead was given no credit at the end of the film.
Yeah. Well, we know the credits, but I'd like to say that part of the reason everybody, you know, between the age of, you know, 38 and 58 knows Night of the Living Dead is because it did slip into public domain. Dude, yeah. It was everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And then when you thought it was gone, it was every Halloween. It was awesome.
And I mean, now, you know, to where it's been the last 3 years where it's just run 24 hours a day for 3 days on AMC with the same recording.
It's never going to go away. And part of that... is because it did slip into public domain.
It was on pay cable this year.
I could kind of see that would be true. How can you debate it? But I mean, I know...
Well, I've been in this business a long time, so sometimes it's nice to have a movie you can do whatever you want with, make fun of, homage, and show. You know, every horror host in America is thankful Night of the Living Dead exists, because it's the best fucking movie they can screen at any given time. The rest are 1930s and 40s, you know, public domain crap off.
And Plan 9.
Yeah, Plan 9, which is another classic. And I will debate it. It runs
it's
in
a classic, but it's not a classic in the same way. It's a classic.
That's a sci-fi film.
Okay, guys, let Kyra say something. You're out shouting.
I'm not going to watch in Vampire, but, you know.
Oh, boys! Let Kyra say something. You're out shouting.
Hey, listen, man. The thespian, the awesome thespian talents of Conrad Brooks cannot be debated. You know, he's just...
No, it can't be.
Over like a motherfucker. But anyway, I guess I would like to repeat that I said the other night, maybe was just that, you know, related to that, how, you know, Bill and I did have a personal deep connection, and I never did have someone that was so much a father figure in my life and someone that could deal with me as a father, you know, and that sometimes was good things and it was sometimes bad things for me because, and I don't know what's going to happen now that I don't got somebody like Bill to, like, keep me in line, like, when I need
think
someone
to
want me back.
You want to do dumb stuff? Think about what he'd tell you. My old man, I always think about dumb shit my old man said. You know?
Yeah.
Piss the bed, wake up wet, you know, he started with stuff like that, and it got better as my dad went along. He was the king of the dumbest ass shit
too.
You ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, I hear my mother's voice in my head. You know, when I'm like faced with some sort of crisis, I think,
all
what
the
would
time,
she say
yeah.
to me? And it's easy to know exactly what she would say. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still me. I'm still in the stage where I still really haven't accepted it yet, kind of thing. And I know that's weird and that's wrong, but it's just like I can't because of all the other stuff I'm going through, and I don't want to talk about that. Of course, this isn't about me, but what I'm saying is just like.
Yeah.
I just, I have
out,
no capacity
though.
At this point.
Take,
like,
take
I just
what you learned and use it.
Guys, talking
I'm
over
sure
each other.
To talk to
Come
Bill.
On.
You know, I feel like that. And like I said, the last 6 months that he was sick, you know, I already had that avenue cut off to me because for most of the last 10 years, like, Bill was the first one that would be talking to me about my problems and giving me advice and being there for me. And I shielded him from the horrors of my life the last 6 months. And that meant that people like Kyra and Ken had to take up more slack. I'm sorry, guys, but and I appreciate it, and I love you guys for it. But I guess I would want to repeat what I said about the fact that, you know, not only did Bill, like, take a hands-on with me like that, I mean, you know, like, we stayed, you know, like, he made his home my home, and my home was his home, and we traveled to so many shows together and had so many great adventures together, and he spent so much time, you know, teaching me what he knew about movie making, from teaching me, you know, the proper way that scenes are shot to, and I mean, Bill, that's the bottom line. I think here's something I think that could be touched on. I mean, part of the story to me that's so amazing about Bill and his career in film, and then subsequently, I mean, it spills over to all the Night Living Dead people, but I always, like, you know, you talk about the little train that could, you know, and you think of, you know, with Kyra's father and George and Jack and Russ and Bill and everybody coming together and saying, hey, let's make this monster movie. Like, this is this idea, like a commercially viable idea, how we can break into making motion pictures. And it was just business, man, like smart, solid plan on how to get something going for themselves. And the biggest thing that they accomplished to me is that, you know, in entertainment, whether it's a band, a film, anything, a wrestling show, you can't do it by yourself. You're not a one-man band. You have to have people come together like a family or a clan or a tribe, and for at least some brief period of time, everybody's got to work together. And the thing that kept impressing me over and over, the more deeply I learned each person involves story in depth at the minutest detail of what went on with Night of the Living Dead, and it's from the years up to that and the years subsequently. It's just the most amazing thing to me that at that time period, everybody was on the same page. And that's, to me, the real key. You can analyze so many things, but the real key factor being that everybody being committed, everybody being involved, everybody believing in getting the job at hand done, and everybody being able to contribute their talents equally. I mean, of course, George will always be given the main credit for Night of the Living Dead, and George deserves a lot of credit, but as everybody involved knows, I mean, everybody contributed so much. There's every little nuance that you don't know who came up with that one moment to think of doing this or this or this or.
Well, you hear the same stories on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it was it was just a smaller degree. But yeah, it's a sense of community. It keeps coming back.
Amazing, and so that accomplishment of a group of people being on the same page and the end result. I mean, that's something that's not debatable. I mean, it exists for all time. It 200 years from now, if mankind still exists, let's cross our fingers, somebody will be watching Night of the Living Dead and be talking about it. Now, there's a really great one. When you talk about stuff, I say with Bill, you know, like the people that know him, you know, he could be stubborn and like anybody else. Well, here was an interesting, very interesting story. I remember the one time I was at Bill's house, and it was dark one winter night or whatever. He said, "Hey, listen, I got to take the trash out the end of the driveway. Come with me." So we went outside and we started getting all his trash cans from the garage, put them in the back of his pickup truck, and then drove it out to the end of his lane. So as we were driving there, Bill said to me, "Well, that's the one great thing about being in a movie like that, you know, like something that hits like Night of the Living Dead." He said, "The bottom line is, if you're in something that's over, you know, that's that iconic that it becomes part of the mass consciousness," he's like, "you know, like, you're immortal. You know, you're immortal. Like, you'll live forever. You're immortal because you're in that. So you've already
accomplished something." Night of the Living Dead holds the honor in my life of, like, most on the bill line never I passed out long before it came on, Dusk to Dawn, you know, bills.
Yeah,
Living Dead played a million times in my life at the drive-in and late-night shows, and bam, I was so drunk I never saw it.
Yeah, so
Not much has changed in my life.
I said to Bill, I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if that's true." And he's like, "What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Look, do you ever see this movie, American Nightmare?" And he's like, "No." I'm like, it's the awesomest documentary on the indie American horror cinema, and Night and Chainsaw and the crazy, like, these are all big movies that are a part of this. He goes, "Yeah." I go, "Well, there's a segment in that film where at the beginning of it, the filmmakers are talking about this new invention, the camera, and, you know, not us still even at this point not really understanding the ramifications of filmed images and everything, because it's been so brief in human history that this stuff has existed, you know." And there's this whole segment in that, and they use the footage of Bela Lugosi from Dracula, and they're talking about how there was a debate that many people thought that this now had provided the means to immortality, and that other people would raise the issue that, is it immortality or is it a way of capturing the spirit? Like, in other words, you're not seeing that person, but instead they are condemned for all time to repeat the same actions. I mean, you're showing Bela Lugosi getting out of the coffin when they're saying this in the movie, but, you know, is it really immortality, or is it a piece of this person's spirit has been captured for eternity and they're just condemned to repeat the same actions over and over again? I said, "You know, Bill, I found that really interesting. You know, if you look at how American Indian people perceive cameras, you know, they're like, 'No, you're not going to take my picture, man. You're going to capture my spirit in that box.'" And I said, "You know, when I saw that movie, I was thinking the same way you did. Like, why you're Bill Hinesman, you know, or Boris Karloff, or you did Frankenstein, or you did Night of the Living Dead. You're immortal." I go, and then these guys said that shit in that movie, and it fucked my head up, man, because I'm thinking, like, wait, maybe my other ancestors were right. Maybe this is the white man, like, capturing your spirit in this box, right? He just, like, Bill just looked at me and said, "Nah, you're fucking immortal, man." I'm not going to consider this fucking debate. You know what I mean? It's like, it's funny because early in the getting to know each other process, when we talk about this, about Night of the Living Dead and this, and social and political and racial and sexual overtones and stuff like that, he goes, "Oh, so in other words, you're one of those fucking guys that reads way too much into a fucking movie." Like, that was what Bill said. You know, you're one of those guys, you know, that just, and, you know, in all truth, I mean, you know, the what someone perceives when they're consuming art, that's part of the beauty of art. It's going to mean something different to every person. You're subjective, and you're going to draw from your own experiences and the own things that you think about. But I also think that's a real kind of nice story to understand, like, that Bill was just, like, a really practical, you know, kind of nuts and bolts guy. He didn't like all that too thick of a head trip kind of shit. You know, he would give me crap for that, you know, but all he wanted to do was keep making movies. That was the only thing. And so I guess what I was going to say, that when I started earlier about the beauty of Bill's story
did, like,
is...
Yeah, if I can cut in for a second, he did, I know from running my show, I mean, over 12 years, he was there, you know, 8-10 times. And he, there, every once in a while, he'd get, someone would hire him for a day here or want to be him in a little indie thing, and... Yep. And I'd never forget, and of a lot of our conversations, he'd be like, I went there and stuck around for 3 days and showed him how to work the damn camera, you know? So there's little indie guys I won't name that can go, well, you know, holy shit, thanks to Bill, he taught me something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, that,
and
he was that kind of guy who, you know, he, that would do that for a fan, you know? He just liked you. If there was something, if he didn't like you, well, he was still courteous to you. But if he did like you, he didn't have anything, any problem doing a little extra special for you.
Right.
I know several,
absolutely.
Guys.
He did the same thing with us. Well, another thing that would happen with that, though, is, you know, then there's the ones that really do jerk you around and waste your time. And, you know, you have to go through a lot of that because we're all looking to do something, and he's trying to be that. I guess what I was going to say, though, was, to me, one of the biggest parts of Bill's story is, like, Bill loved movies as a kid growing up. And he later, of course, began to love movies even more. I mean, Bill's favorite, I mean, Bill would have been the first one to tell somebody he's not a horror fan. He really wasn't a horror fan. I know it freaks a lot of people out, but he'd be the first one to say it. And, you know, Bill liked watching John Ford and Orson Welles movies, you know what I mean, and big, you know, epics of the 40s and 50s, things along that nature. I mean, he just...
Yeah, but he saw everything in a camera. He was a director.
Yeah, he loved cinema that was done, you know, really well. But I think what I was going to say...
Yeah, we've had these
discussions.
I'm going to agree with you, yeah.
One of the most fascinating things about Bill's story to me is, unlike a lot of us, you know, Bill did not set out with the idea that he wanted to be in the film business. And for the fans that out there and friends that don't know it, part of Bill's story I can share with you is that for Bill, how that all happened basically was that he was in his late teens, I think it was. He was working in a photo factory in Pittsburgh, and basically this factory, what they did was they were producing like at least half of the publicity 8x10s in the United States. At that point, they did all the ones for the WWWF, and they were doing them for different bands and actors, and this factory, you know, produced, and for regular people too, but, you know, it was a photo producing factory or whatever. And so he said the one weekend, you know, while he's at work, the boss was there, and he said, hey, move all that junk out in there and, like, throw it away and blah, blah, blah. And he looked, and there was this big, bulky camera, still camera, like a big antiquated, like, from the 30s or something.
Yeah, movable front
still
box.
Camera. And he's like, you're going to throw this away? And the guy's like, yeah. And he goes, does it work? And he goes, yeah, but it's old junk. And he's like, does this camera work? And he said, yeah. He goes, can I have it? And he said, if you want that piece of crap, take it. So Bill took that camera home, and, you know, he got it for free out of the junk, and he started taking pictures. And this is when he fell in love with photography, and he started taking the pictures. Well, this led all the way to him having a job as a forensic photographer at crime scenes and auto accidents and stuff like that. And I don't know how the exact connection got made, but at whatever point, you know, Bill hooked up with George and Jack and Russ in the time period that they were forming Latent Image.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Billy, hold that thought. We got to go to break.
Going to break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Attention all personnel. You got it. You got it. You found the most listened to radio station. Jackalope Radio.
And we're back, 42nd Street Pete.
Hey, we're joined by Ed Demko. Welcome to what we laughingly call the show this weekend. How you doing?
I'm doing good, guys. How's everybody doing?
Hey, good. We're just, you know, telling some Bill stories. If you got one, chime in, you know?
Well, as a Pittsburgher, Bill's a guy that I always remember, obviously, from Night of the Living Dead, but he was a guy that kind of, I guess, played ambassador to horror movies for years and years in the city. He'd always be at shows. He'd always, you know, be in the outfit from Night of the Living Dead, which is awesome. But the thing is, man, I think that Bill never got the credit that he deserved for the role that he played. Because when you think about, you know, horror films and stuff, everybody remembers the guy that played the seminal characters. You know what I mean? You remember, you know, Bela Lugosi as Dracula. You remember, you know, just on and on and on. But Bill essentially did something in Night of the Living Dead that I don't even know if he realized what he was doing. He played the first zombie of, you know, that second wave of zombie movies as we know them now.
Yeah, modern you know, era zombie. Yeah.
Exactly. And he set that stage without, I'm sure, even thinking about it so much. And he really, really set the stage, because if you think about the history of zombie movies, when you actually think of the zombies themselves, Bill has to be one of the first ones that come to mind.
Well, absolutely, and he was perfect for the part. Me and Kyra mentioned it the other day, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was perfect because he was so skinny, and he didn't even really need a lot of makeup because he was so skinny and cadaverous, and he was creepy. He was just very, very creepy, and he didn't need the bloody wounds and the gashes and the gore and stuff, and he just, you know, he was perfect. And when I think of, like, a ghoul, because that's what we were, we weren't zombies, the word
zombie
had come about, but, you know, he's the one who springs to mind. I mean, he's the one who's really kind of stuck in my head as sort of the quintessential ghoul, or he was the first zombie, the first modern zombie. And, you know, when I think of zombies, I think of Bill. I don't even think of myself. I think of Bill, you know.
I agree with what Ed had to say, but also I was going to throw in that, well, you know, another little iconic zombie is Kyra, and you can be humble as you want. But, like, I think to accentuate what Ed was saying, you know, Bill told a lot of great stories about, I mean, a lot of you fans may know or may not know that the opening scene was actually the last thing that was filmed, and Bill had debates with George of, like, what do you mean I'm going to chase her? What do you mean I'm going to break a rock with a window? Like, before we were weak and we couldn't move fast, and George was like, just fucking kill her, you know, like, so it's, and then, you know, Bill, it's what you said about the classic images and Boris Karloff and things. I mean, at 10 years old, when I first saw Night of the Living Dead, that opening scene, the way it affected me was that, yes, I thought I'm like, my first words at 10 years old was like, oh my God, this guy's like Boris Karloff, look at him. And, you know, at that moment, it wasn't registering well, the physique, you know, the low shots, the way, you know, George chose to shoot him and everything very much gave him that same kind of presence as a Karloff and a Frankenstein or something like that. And then to find out Bill years later giving credit and saying, look, that he basically subconsciously stole the walk from Boris Karloff from The Walking Dead, where he was the, you know, in the movie The Walking Dead, Boris Karloff was the guy that was wrongfully executed.
Yeah, the streak down his hair, the white streak for being electrocuted.
Came back to get revenge. So Bill credited that he had actually lifted the walk from Boris Karloff, and I've always seen such an obvious resemblance between the two of them. So I think what Ed said and what Kyra just accentuated, I think that Bill will always be, you know, when you think of zombie, I think of him first and I think of Kyra second. I mean, that's me, because that's the two things that most affected me and always will from the movie. I mean, it still hold up, you know, today. I mean, you can still not do anything with a zombie that's scarier to me than the scenes that Kyra and Bill were essential in. And then, once again, back to what I was saying before the break, for him to come from a point of just, you know, like a blue-collar person slowly working his way through opportunity to where he becomes the guy you know, that's that first zombie, and I guess we all agree that, you know, some Cairo was talking about his attributes as that zombie, and I know originally he was not the one that was scheduled to portray that zombie in that scene, and George making that decision, hey, Bill, how about you do this? And you look at how, you know, the rest of the movie, you see him, it's actually mistakes, because you see Bill appearing physically impossible in many of the scenes that are cut together, because he's over here by these zombies fighting by the guts, and then you show the next shot, and these other ones are over here, and he's there, and he just was put in so many shots in the film that you just constantly see him, and I think that those physical attributes, I mean, if anybody can picture if Bill was not the one, you know, that played the zombie in the cemetery, I think it would have been a completely different movie because of what he contributed, and maybe, Ed's right, maybe he didn't realize what he was contributing at the moment, but go figure. How are you going to second guess it? Because it can never be done better.
Since that was the action, the first of the, you know, modern day zombie films I ever saw, I can't imagine it being different. You know, it'd be a fun spoof to do the front scene, do the first scene, but with several different zombies. You know?
Yeah, I agree.
Use zombies from other films and then use them in that context. And
hey, Kyra, I wanted to ask you something. What's your favorite memory of Bill?
Oh, gee. I don't know. I mean, I've known him for so long, for most of my life. And it's hard to say. I mean, we got much closer, obviously, as we were doing conventions. And, you know, hanging out and, you know, I drove with him to, where was it? St. Louis? Where was it? No, Indianapolis. That's right. We didn't drive to St. Louis. We drove to Indianapolis. And it was just really fun because we were, you know, well, first I drove up to his farm, which is like way, way out of the way, north. And then we ended up coming, you know, back south and he drove his car. And so we were in the car for like ever. But, you know, it was just nice because we just got to talk a whole lot about stuff that wasn't even Night of the Living Dead related, and you know, it was just nice hanging out with him. And he was very protective of me, I think, particularly after my dad died. And I could tell that he was kind of looking out for me at the conventions. He would sort of run interference with, you know, maybe like if he perceived that a guy was like hanging around too much or something, he would kind of give people a hard time, you know. And he actually, even before my dad died, you know, back many years ago, you know, he would always kind of look out for me, and he told me that he thought of me as like his little sister. And you know, that's what he was like. He was like an older brother or an uncle for me. And you know, he was just a lot of fun, you know, and we'd hang out afterwards and have drinks in the bar and just have a good time.
Okay, yeah, I got you. I think we lost Billy there, but he's trying to call us back. I want to bring him back in. Hello, Billy, are you here?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, what happened?
I don't know, crazy phone lines, but you're back. And yeah, Kyra was just telling us, I didn't want to answer in the middle of her statement there. She was just telling us a little bit about her favorite memory of Bill, and that was pretty touching, I thought.
Oh, cool. Now I missed it. I'll have to listen to the archives.
Yeah, definitely. So where
Ed,
were we?
Ed, you still there?
Ed.
Yeah, I'm here.
Good, okay. Ed. Good.
Say something.
Yeah.
Chime in.
You know, one of the things that this is really cool, and obviously I have to thank Ken for this, because this is like inadvertent, but the last time I ever seen Bill was at Cinema Wasteland. And obviously he was there, you know, doing the thing, signing the autographs, meeting people all day long, wearing the outfit, which is obviously really cool. But the last time I ever saw Bill was down in the lobby of the hotel at probably like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And Bill was just kind of walking around and drinking beer and just kind of, you know, like going from group to group and just kind of talking to people. And I just thought it was really cool.
We oftentimes, you know, looked at each other and said, it's 3:30, 4 in the morning. Do you think us old men should go to bed? And I said, yeah, but I got to be up before you. So we go, you know, sometimes I'd leave him. It's like, I'm going, man. I got to get like 3 hours. I got to get up in 3 hours. I always thought that was funny, too.
Yeah, well, that was, I just thought it was,
Go ahead, Ed.
I was just going to say, I always thought it was cool that, you know, just, like, Bill never took himself as, like, a guest. It's like, once the show is done,
he was
down there with everybody else.
Yeah. Well, that goes back, I think, to just his whole blue-collar, working-class guy from Pittsburgh kind of ethic that he always carried with him all the time. I mean, you know, he didn't just put on an air of being civil to people, like, for that occasion. I mean, that was just how Bill was in real life.
Man,
I mean, like,
I
was
fans, man. Yeah, you know, Petey, I mean, from Florida Square Fest was here the other night, and that's what he's like. Man, Bill was always up with the fans for way late in the morning, and then first thing up in the morning, have the makeup on, you know, ready for the crowd.
You know, Bill always struck me as the kind of guy that was, regardless if he was doing a convention or if he was making a movie or no matter what he was doing, he always kind of had that mentality of, let's roll up the sleeves and put the hard hat on and get to work. I mean, regardless of what it is, I'm just going to make the best of it, and it's going to, you know, it'll be a good time for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yep, exactly. I agree. You know, he did have that ethic, you know. Loved his family more than anything. I mean, his wife and his daughter more than anything, his son on this earth, his friends. Loved working. I mean, some of my fun is, I like, you know, they've got a couple hundred acres out there and everything. I remember the one day we were just showing my friend that had never been out there before, and it was in the fall, and like all the goldenrod and stuff was like 6 feet high on like the tons of acres and all, and like we just get in Bill's little pickup truck and he's just like out there like battling through the weeds, you know what I mean, with like the pollen and the dust and the flowers and just bees and everything all over. And like, you know, he's always out there feeding the horses, cutting the grass with the tractor. I mean, there was that whole other part of him. I mean, he did have a lot of connection to the land and the outdoors and stuff like that, and he enjoyed that a lot too, you know. But movie making, the passion, and I think he had a passion for people, you know, more than anything. I mean, as far as what we're all talking about here is just the way he was like a regular social butterfly and just treated everybody. I mean, the bottom line is, 9 times out of 10, if you were around Bill Hinesman, he made you feel good, you know what I mean, unless something was going on that was unavoidable. But I mean, he was just usually one of those, not just roll up your sleeves and get the job done, but hey, and make the best of the work part of it, but let's just have a good time in any situation, you know. And he was like always kind of at the forefront of what would go on with Bill, you know. He just awesome. Now I'm trying to not talk too much and you guys are leaving this dead air. See, I'm trying to adapt.
How much time we got left, Todd?
You got about 7 minutes, it looks like.
Okay,
6 minutes?
7 minutes. Well, that's time enough for final thoughts from everybody, I would think. You know, any final thoughts, Kyra?
Well, I just know the conventions are going to be a lot lonelier. Last year I didn't do any conventions with him at all because of his illness, and they were not the same experience for me at all. It was lonely. I missed my buddy. He was like my teammate, you know. We always sat together at conventions we would do, and that's going to be rough going forward, knowing that he will not be coming back to them, because I'd hoped, and he had hoped too, that he would be back on the convention circuit again this year, and you know, now that's not going to be happening. And so yeah, it's going to be lonelier. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that for anybody that's, you know, a regular part of the convention scene and stuff like that, I mean Bill's part of the extended family of everybody, and I know that all the fans and all the people that attend regularly are deeply affected by this. And of course Kyra's right, I mean, things will not be the same in that respect in the convention world. And I mean, for us personally that are very close to Bill, I mean, my life will not be the same. I've lost somebody that just is so crucial to keeping Billy Graham on some kind of track. I don't even, like, I know I have this gap now, you know, that I'm not going to be able to fill. I know that, and I know that the things he shared with me and the things that he taught me are things that are going to be always an interview of mine that exists somewhere that we did for that doc. I told this story, but, and most of the night participants know this, but I credit Night of the Living Dead with saving my life twice. And, like, the first time, and it's weird because at your show, the first weekend that we met, Bonnie and I actually had this conversation sitting in the restaurant there at the Holiday Inn, because she said, "Oh my God, what year were you born?" And I was like, 1960, and she went, "Oh my God, Billy." I go, "What?" She goes, "I've always said that anybody that was born between 1958 and 1964 just had it the worst, because how are you a baby and you're brought up in this world of your first images being put in your head is like riots in the streets, race clash, Vietnam, people dying on the television every night,
tough,
political.
Brother made us tough.
Yeah. You know, being people being assassinated and shit like that, and I'm like, well, you know, it's funny
family
you would bring that up.
Dying at Nam. I remember cousins funny. And uncles going, man.
I'm like, you know, yeah, and yeah, me too, relatives, uncles, you know, and like, but what I said to Bonnie, I said, man, it's so cool that you're conscious of that, because I said, and that's part of my connection to Night Living Dead. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, well, from the time I was like cognizant till I was 10 years old and I saw that movie, I said, all I had in the back of my mind all the time, I had nightmares at night and everything, and this sense of impending doom, because I thought the only reason I existed was so that I could go die in Vietnam. You know, like no matter what I do, it doesn't matter, because when I turn 16, they're going to send me over there to die. You know what I mean? And this is,
that was my era too, dude. That's
yeah,
that's what drove me to 42nd Street and hanging out and shit. Because I had that hanging over my head too.
I didn't see the movie till 1970. I was 10 years old, and my other famous Monsters artist buddy that was my best friend
that
drew all the
13,
pictures.
He had seen it
like five times and he was lording it over me that, you know, you haven't seen the best horror movie yet. This is the best horror movie. And then family resistance to letting me see it because they're reading tawdry things about it in newspapers that it's pornographic and what kind of people would make this disgusting movie. So finally, 1970, on the Dusk Till Dawn, Sinking Spring Drive-In, I finally stay up all night and get to see it, you know, at 4:30 a.m. or whatever. And when I saw the movie, it was terrifying me, but then slowly, as the events took hold, it just, like, it altered me subconsciously. And at the end of the movie, what I walked away with at 10 years old was, like, having a place of what do you want to call it, like, kind of, like, peace, like, inner peace, because what the movie put onto me at 10 years old was, like, look, in this movie, like, there was all kinds of people. They were black, they were white, they were young, they were old, they were men, they were women. Some tried to do the right thing, some tried to do the other right thing, and no matter what they all did, at the end, they were all fucking dead, okay? Like, it didn't matter in the end who was arguing what. It didn't matter whose position was what. It doesn't matter who was good and bad. The bottom line is, in the end, we're all fucked anyway. You know what I mean? So I was like, wow, if I look at things like that, like, you know, it's not so bad, really. You know what I mean? So that was the first time, because it really just made me healthier mentally. And I'm like, why do you think this movie's bad? It made me, like, able to sleep at night, you know. And then when I was in my 30s, you know, my Indian politics stuff had led me to getting so involved in what was going on in the Iroquois War with New York State and Quebec that I found myself as a full-time militant and activist. And now I'm sitting at a house in the res, and there's, like, three grandmothers and 20 children and one uncle and me in there, and about 200 rounds from an SK come through the wall, spraying the building, and everyone hits the floor, and people are screaming. And Uncle says, okay, Billy, like, let's go outside. And I'm like, and he's like, look, there's another SK in that trailer right there. You got to go get it. And I'm like, wait, the trailer between me and they're shooting, like, he's like, don't worry, I'm gonna. And it's like, I'm not given a choice. So I run while he's shooting. I get this SK. I bring it back to him. And I go, here it is. He goes, why are you giving it to me? That's yours. And I'm like, mine? I'm like, I shoot handguns and shotguns and hunting. I never shot a gun like this. I'm like, he's like, dude, point it and squeeze. I did, the Chinese SK. And I'm like, okay. He goes, look. He goes, these guys, there's like at least 20 of them out there. They're like completely armed. He goes, this is what I need you to do. I need you to go over there by my house, come up beside the house, distract them so I can get around them in the woods and start shooting to get them out of there. So I'm like, fuck, you know. And so I'm creeping down the side of this house thinking I'm Tonto or whatever. And I'm along the side of the house hugging it, and I look down, and there's a red dot on the center of my chest. Well, this is how you can tell this is a real story, because I'm not G.I. Joe. My reaction when I looked down and saw the red dot on the center of my chest was I dropped the gun, and with both hands I tried to swat the red dot off my chest like it was a bee. Okay, like just complete panic, right? And then I had the good sense to drop myself into the dirt and grab for the gun again, and I'm like, a couple rounds hitting the dirt around me, and I'm like, Billy Graham, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, you're here, and these guys are going to kill you. You know what I mean? And then it just hit me that this is where your beliefs lead, and then for some reason, the next thing that went through my head was Night of the Living Dead. I saw Dwayne Jones fighting off zombies with a 2x4 in his hand, and I was like, wow. You know, like, it's like, this is what it is, dude. Your beliefs led you to where you are. You're trapped in the farmhouse. Like, you got two options. It's like, run or fight. If you run, don't ever mention any of this shit again. Don't have an opinion about it, okay? Or fight. So I got up and shot back at him. You know what I mean? But I wouldn't have if Night of the Living Dead would have not entered my head. At that key moment when I was about to die, the movie came into my head, and what was the message? To fight. You know, to fight was there. You know, survive. Yeah. Survival. Oops. You know, so that was the second time I credit it with affecting my life to the point of saving it, you know. So yeah. Tell me about what you can gain from art. I mean, man, people, just all you got to do is just put in the movie again and watch it again, man, and you know that, I mean, Bill Hinesman loved every one of the fans, loved all his family, his coworkers, and was just a great example to me of a great human being. And how do you put that in words? I know that to me, I lost my dad to me, and I'm not going to have another person that influenced like that. And man, like, I can't think of any of us being at a convention that we're not going to always be reminiscing about Bill and crazy stories with Bill. And fans, just keep his memory alive, man, and watch as much stuff as you can. And I go out and see that River of Darkness, the last movie he did with Kurt Angle and him and Joe Shelby and all those wrestlers, Kevin Nash and stuff in it, because I thought he did a really good job as Harvey Hicks in that movie. So, check out his last part, I think, would be another good thing to do.
Ken?
Yeah.
And he is your, oh, by the way, he won the debate. I'm sorry, Ken. Yeah. I think he won the debate. Bill Hinesman is immortal. He won that argument with me. He's immortal. I'm sorry, guys.
Oh, I hope, yeah. Bill Hinesman, he will forever be immortal, especially thanks to public domain. But, Bill, man, when I started Wasteland Show in, what, September 2000, Bill was, you know, he was on the guest list. I think Kyra might have been on the guest list. But
I wasn't.
You came at the next one? Anyway, I went. I can't remember. I know Bill was there because, you know, that's how I started my show. 12 years ago, I called friends. So I know he was there, and I know he was the, I think his last show was my show. So, you know, and all the ones in between, Wasteland lost a family member. So I was happy to know him. I have a lot more stories I'd never tell on the radio than I would tell about him. So, and I was happy to know him. So Wasteland lost a family member and one more, man.
None of them involved farm animals or homosexual acts. Not a single one of those stories.
I've lost a year ago. Me and Pete lost Dave Friedman, a mentor toward both of us. This year we lost Bill Hinesman. Both, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Wasteland family. So
Ed?
Yeah, Matt. I was just going to say that, you know, I've met Bill on plenty of different occasions. He was always a pleasant guy to meet and always somebody I looked forward to talking to. And, you know, I didn't have the connection that some of the other people on the show here might have had with him. But, I mean, it's safe to say that as a fan of horror films in general, the guy changed my life. I mean, without Night of the Living Dead and without his performance and that movie being the way that it was, you know, things wouldn't be the same. And, I mean, he had a profound impact on my life and the life of many other people. And I think that's important. And I don't know how many times Bill's heard this in his life, but, you know, the only thing I could say is thank you.
Yeah, same here. Back in 68, he scared the shit out of me. I got to meet him. He was a cool guy. I always enjoyed talking to him, having a beer or two with him, and Kyra's right. The convention circuit isn't going to be the same without him, and the world of horror isn't going to be the same without him. So we're going to miss you, buddy. And thanks for all you guys coming back on and making the show really cool. And we'll see you next week.
to the ticket window for a mere $3.50. That's your ticket to an all-night, 24/7 evening at the Grindhouse. You want spaghetti westerns? How about the man with no name? Django. Yeah, they're all in here. How about some bikers like the Hell's Angels, Satan's Slaves, Satan's Sadists? You want some blood and guts? Well, how about H.G. Lewis, Andy Milligan, John Carpenter, George A. Romero, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Ghastly Ones, Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS? All those hot, horny mistresses guaranteed to dominate your dreams. They're all yours right here in the Grindhouse.
So grab yourself a seat on Saturday night. The